It's a pleasure to be here. The Kol Yom Rishon program is a spectacular addition to the repertoire of Yeshiva University. It's easy to not give credit to the people who organize it. So I just want to stop and give credit to Yeshiva for organizing a Kol Yom Rishon of this. And thank you very much for being involved in the sponsorship of the Kol Yom Rishon. The truth is that the sharing of Torah outside the confines of the Yeshiva to a larger audience ought to be part and parcel of the mission of any and every Torah institution. And this is a wonderful forum for doing that. I'm going to be talking in a very halacha v'maisa practical way about five issues that everybody encounters, or virtually everybody encounters, working as an Orthodox professional out there, outside of the Torah community, meaning some of us are privileged to have a job in which everybody who works with us and for us are religious Jews, but most of us don't. Most of us don't even want such a job. Even if we wanted such a job, there are a few such jobs available. It's hard to be a lawyer who only has religious clients. It's hard to be a doctor who only has religious patients, and so on and so forth. And the world out there entails many complicated issues because normal people, i.e. clients, don't obey Jewish law, patients, they raise all sorts of halakha questions revolving around different issues. I'm going to address five of them. I'm going to address keeping kosher in a not kosher environment. I'm going to address issues relating to yichud and tzniut from a man's perspective in a world in which people don't generally adhere to the halachic standards of yichud and tzniut. I'm going to deal with a smattering of Shabbat issues. I'm going to deal with the question of assisting people who want to engage in an impropriety. Then I'm going to deal with more general issues under the rubric of Kedoshim Tiyu and Chukos Hagoyim. And I'm going to try to spend about 10 minutes on each of these issues, and then I'm going to be exceptionally rude and run out because I'm giving the Kol Yom Rishon at 10:30 in the Women's Division, so I can't stay here and answer questions. I'm sorry about that. I want to start with the question of assisting people in sin, because it's an extremely important, almost central question that every Orthodox professional encounters. Patients, clients, people who work with you and for you come to you and ask you to assist them in conduct that violates Jewish law, and yet they're Jewish. Or they're not Jewish, and they come to you and want you to assist them in conduct that violates one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. They don't want you to do it. They want you to help them. We'll start with just the simplest question, which is you're at a company lunch, sitting around the table, and you're eating your kosher meal that your company ordered from you from the local kosher caterer, and the Jew sitting next to you who's not religious says to you, "Can you pass me the ham sandwich over there? Can you pass this to me?" In the sense of the way every civilized person behaves, which is you don't get up and walk across the table to get your food. You turn to the person and say, "Can you pass it to me?" Can you pass to somebody food that isn't kosher when they themselves are Jewish? Or you have to be incredibly uncivilized and say, "No, I can't pass it to you. Please get up and get it yourself." And while that's just a little question, the permutations of this little question reverberate throughout all sorts of conduct in your work. When you're a lawyer, a client comes in and says, "Would you write a will for me? It's true I have a wife, but I want to leave all my money to my girlfriend and not to my wife." Or as a doctor, a woman comes to you asking for contraception, and you say, "But you're not married." Or you're married and your husband has had a vasectomy, to which the answer is, "Nonetheless, I need birth control." So the question is, what's your role as a professional in this type of a situation? Never mind a second issue that we'll touch on, which is when somebody comes to you with a plan to violate secular law, and they need your advice on how to violate secular law. These are all very, very common occurrences in the professional workforce, Mostly because the normal people who are Jewish, whatever exactly normal means, secular people, don't feel any fidelity to obey Jewish law. And the notion that you as a professional who's serving them should not serve them because their request violates Jewish law is hard for them to imagine. They, by the way, will solve this problem when you say to them, I can't assist you in doing this because this violates Jewish law by doing what? Going somewhere else. That's what they do. They don't say to you, you're a bad person. They don't hit you. They just fire you. And they find somebody else who accommodates all of their lawful goals and desires. This halakhic issue is not new at all, but it is very, very, very central and important. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah distinguishes between two kinds of assistance that a person provides for sinful conduct. One is called one side of the river, and one is called two sides of the river. The Gemara draws the following distinction. When the person can't engage in the sinful activity but for your assistance, you've engaged in a Torah violation of the rules of Lifnei Iver. When, on the other hand, if you decline to assist, there's a whole line of people who are happy to assist. That's not a Torah violation of Lifnei Iver at all. That's a violation of the prohibition of Misayeya Yidei Ovrei Aveira, assisting people who are setting out to sin. And that's the central prohibition we're talking about in this context. The Ramah, based on the Ran, makes the following observation. Really, the Ramah says, Misayeya Yidei Ovrei Aveira, assisting people in sin, is not sinful conduct at all. It's just ein ruach hachamim lo chayimim. This conduct is discouraged, doesn't represent either a Torah violation or a rabbinic violation, when the person who's requesting that you help them in sin can do the conduct without you. Well, this is based on the Ran's observation that it's futile to not participate in such a situation, because whether you participate or not, you know what happens?
It's a sin.
The sin. And the Shach adds on to this an even stronger observation. The Shach says there are really two cases. The first case is when a person who's generally observant wants to violate Jewish law in a fit of temptation. In that situation, the Shach says there's a rabbinic prohibition to assist them in sin. But when the Shach says, when the person who's sinning wants to sin and will sin no matter what you do, and you can't possibly persuade them not to sin, in such a situation, no violation of Jewish law occurs. The Shach bases this on his following big picture view, which I think is normative in Jewish law. There is no prohibition to separate a person from sin, lahafrish yehudim me'isur, to separate a Jew from sin when the Jew wants to sin. The obligation to separate a person from sinning is only when the person doesn't really want to sin. Either he doesn't know it's a sin, or he's overcome by temporary temptation. But when a person sets out knowingly, consciously, intentionally, to engage in conduct that violates Jewish law, because that's what they want, you're under no obligation to separate them from sin at all. And based on this, many halakhic authorities note that it's not a sin, not a violation of Jewish law when you facilitate but don't enable a person to sin by providing them with goods that they can otherwise get without you. So you're running a kosher store, you have meat on this side and dairy on this side, and in comes somebody to your kosher store and says, I'd like to buy some meat and some cheese because I'm making cheeseburgers. And you're just selling meat to everybody. This analysis says that, you know what you can say to them? Well, the hamburger is $3.75 a pound and the cheese is $5 a pound. How much do you want? You're not obligated to say to them, gosh, that conduct is violative of Jewish law. I can't sell you meat, or I can't sell you cheese. Now, if you look at this person in your list, if they're a person who doesn't know You can't mix meat and milk together. Then you have to say something to them. But if it's somebody who's sinning because they want to sin, our custom, our practice is that we participate in this sin on a commercial level. We sell goods to people, notwithstanding the fact that they're going to use them in sinful ways. You're running an electronics store. Somebody comes in Friday at 3 o'clock and says, I'm having a big party in my house tonight at 9 o'clock. What's a suitable radio to play music for? You don't have to turn to them and say, I can't sell you a radio now that you've told me it's going to violate Shabbat. And although this issue sounds obvious and mundane, it's an exceptionally important halakhic principle for an Orthodox professional. All of us who work in professional settings encounter both colleagues and clients who want to employ us in a way where the underlying activity violates Jewish law. And the question is, how much do you want to participate in that activity? My first foray into the practice of law was a summer associate at the now defunct law firm of Shea and Gould. Mr. Shea was the Shea of, it used to be Shea Stadium. I think there's no longer a Shea Stadium either. There's no longer a Shea and Gould. There's no longer a Shea Stadium. I took this job to discover in my first day on the job that the single largest client at Shea and Gould was a well-known magazine called Penthouse. Honestly, I wouldn't have taken the job had I known, but who investigates these things? It was a law firm. I took it, and I found it on the first day, and I said, the first time we came in, I don't think I want to do this assignment, I don't want to do work for Penthouse. And I was pulled aside immediately and said, we'll honor this request in the summer, but you should know that you won't get an offer. You won't be invited to come back here to work if you're not interested in doing assignments for Penthouse because they're the largest client of the firm. To which I said, okay, I'm going into academia anyway, I can deal with that. But I could well understand how in many law firms, associates and even partners don't have the luxury of looking up and saying, this client is in a business that violates Jewish law. Penthouse is in a business where every single thing it does violates Jewish law. That's just the truth. There's no kosher side to the Penthouse business, let me assure you. At least that I know of. And nonetheless, as a lawyer who's asked to do something like a real estate closing for Penthouse, that's what I was asked to do. I was asked to work on a real estate transaction. And I could very well understand how a lawyer by routine, when a client comes in the office and says, I want to pay for your services. So the lawyer says, great. And even after investigation, it turns out that the client is engaged in conduct whose core business is a violation of Jewish law. Notwithstanding the fact that a lawyer wants to do real estate closings for Penthouse, we would say such conduct is the kind of conduct that Baalei Nefesh should stay away from, pious people shouldn't do, but doesn't represent a central violation of Jewish law. And I think the same thing is true when you're an OBGYN and you're giving out contraception to somebody who's not married. Or all sorts of other conduct where what you're doing is you're facilitating a violation of Jewish law by somebody else, but you're not doing the violation at all. You're doing a real estate closing, or you're providing the birth control pills, or many different other aspects where what you're doing is misayeya yide over yaveira. Your conduct facilitates, but doesn't enable the violation of Jewish law. I have the sense from answering practical challenges by professionals that this is a very important central issue. Most clients don't obey Jewish law. Most clients don't obey Jewish law because most Jews are not observant of Jewish law, and most Gentiles are not observant of Noahide law, I think. And in such a situation, you come as a professional not to do the underlying sin, but to do the legwork associated with creating a transaction that facilitates the sin. So I think that when the guy sitting next to you around the table says, can you pass me a ham sandwich? And his last name is Goldstein, and he is perfectly and completely Jewish, Halacha says you can say yes to him, and you can reach over and grab a ham sandwich and pass it to him, notwithstanding the fact that after you pass it to him, he's going to eat it. The rationale for this is that if you say, no, I can't pass it to you, he'll just get up and get it himself. No less sinning will take place. He'll only think more poorly of you. Now, the question is, in such a situation, how comfortable are you identifying yourself as a religious Jew? That's a more complicated social conversation. The fact is that Rav Huttner told many people in many different settings that if you're in the business of being the Sayyei day over Avera at work, you know what you should do? Not wear an armor. You should not wear yarmulke if you're going to, by routine, be misayed in the day over and over, because that's the nature of the business that you're in. He thought that it was more appropriate not to wear yarmulke at work. I don't know. When you talk to halakhic authorities about how to handle those kinds of situations, are you better off wearing a kippah or not? In fact, the standards have changed a little bit. It used to be 50 years ago that the people thought not to wear yarmulke at work. In this situation, the counter argument is that wearing a yarmulke at work keeps all Malkut Shemayim firmly on your shoulders, in public and in private. And although I understand the Rav Huttner's argument, my intuition is that I tell people never to take their kippah off at work, because wearing a kippah inclines them to stay more connected and less likely to drift away. But there are halachic authorities who say if you're in the business of doing real estate closings for Pentax, and at the end of a large real estate closing, somebody stands around and takes a picture and publishes it in the Real Estate Times. And the Real Estate Times says, Penthouse closes on 357, East 42nd Street. And over here is the president of Penthouse, and over here is Shmuel Goldstein, his attorney, wearing his yarmulke with his sits out. There's something low toes about it. Even though Shmuel Goldstein says it, he asked him, I just do the real estate closing. Rav Huttner's point is that the casual seer of the picture won't understand. And that'll produce an aspect of a Chilul Hashem. So this is a very complicated issue on a social level, but halachically, a person who's a misayeya in the day over and over facilitates a person who engages in a violation of Jewish law has many halachic authorities to rely on. The Ramah is inclined in that direction. The Shach is even more inclined in that direction. The Nodes of Yehuda reinforces the view of the Shach. The Rav Hashulchan accepts this view. And Rav Moshe and our current generation accepted that view as well. If you don't rely on this view, functioning in the professional world, in an assisting profession like law or medicine, where you really are serving the wishes of your clients, is very hard to do. I think, by the way, there's a difference here between facilitating a violation of Jewish law and facilitating a violation of secular law. Interestingly enough, I think facilitating a violation of secular law is a more serious halakhic problem, mostly because in many situations, once you know it's a violation of secular law, what your client wants to do, you too are in violation of secular law. And once you too are in violation of secular law, halacha says you have to stay far away. So your client comes to you and says something like, take the hardest case. I'm sending drugs from Colombia to the United States. Can you facilitate the wire transfer? The answer is no. And the reason why the answer is no is because once you know what the wire transfer is for, you become part of the conspiracy. You yourself are abutting on a violation of secular law. Then Allah would say to you, since you yourself become the principal, you have to stay far away from that type of activity. So I think it's more complicated when you're engaging in a violation of secular law, because almost inevitably the conspiracy challenges entrap you as a principal, whereas in Jewish law, because if they either is a self-standing independent prohibition, it's not always true that you become a principal when you yourself facilitate a violation of Jewish law, even though it is true when you facilitate a violation of secular law. Second thing I want to talk about is keeping kosher in a not kosher world. And I want to specifically address the question of what a person can eat in a not kosher restaurant. That's what I want to focus on. I know it's much better to insist that one always goes to a kosher restaurant. And I also know that there are many situations where it's not possible. And that clients take you where clients take you. And that when you say, I'm not going to a kosher restaurant, I'm not going to a not kosher restaurant, the answer is you're left out of many activities. I want to start first with Rav Moshe's amazing. Rav Moshe writes that you can't go into a not kosher restaurant and have them send you a kosher meal. A rat kosher meal. Rav Moshe says the reason why you can't do that is because that violates Marzayim. Because people will see you eating in a non-kosher restaurant, you know what they'll assume? That you're eating trash. Because who knows that you've gotten a kosher meal delivered? How would anybody know that? So although Rav Moshe says this, I think that Rav Moshe's analysis is now out of date. Not that he was wrong when he said it, but he said it in a time that was a totally different situation where kosher meals were more or less unavailable. Everybody now knows, even in Atlanta, Georgia, where you can count the number of people who keep kosher only in the low thousands. There aren't a lot of people who keep kosher in Atlanta where I hail from. Nonetheless, there isn't a business restaurant in Atlanta that doesn't provide kosher meals. If you ask for a kosher meal, they get you one. It's not a problem, and everybody knows this. So I think even though Rav Moshe says you can't even eat certified kosher food in a not kosher restaurant because people will assume you're not keeping kosher, and that's a Marzayim prohibition, I think that that's not correct. That if I were to show you a picture of an eminent Torah scholar sitting in a not kosher restaurant eating, what would you assume? You assume it's kosher food. Now, I'm not sure if that applies to a McDonald's. I think it's very halakhically problematic to go into a McDonald's and order a soda. The Coca-Cola at McDonald's is kosher. The Coca-Cola at McDonald's is kosher. You can even buy cans. The cans are for sure kosher. But I think that when you go into McDonald's to buy something that's kosher, that's a very serious Marzayim problem because McDonald's doesn't have that kind of structure. Where normal people go in and buy a kosher item. I don't think that that's true in many other settings, and certainly in a fancy business setting, it's well understood that you can go into a not kosher restaurant, and they'll deliver to you a kosher meal certified and wrapped, and that there's not a Marzayim problem. It's even more problematic, by the way, when you step into a restaurant like Dunkin' Donuts, which is certified kosher in some places, and certified and not certified kosher in other places, and you step into a not kosher Dunkin' Donuts wearing your yarmulke to buy a cup of coffee. Now, I think the coffee and all the Dunkin' Donuts are kosher, but here, Rav Moshe's point is there's a pretty serious Marzayim problem. The viewer who sees a frozen Jew leaving a Dunkin' Donuts might reasonably conclude that, you know what this is? This is one of the kosher Dunkin' Donuts, because everybody knows there are a number of kosher Dunkin' Donuts, and he'll go in and eat the donuts from this place. My own experience in the rabbinate was that myself and another rabbi in Atlanta stepped into the Dunkin' Donuts in our neighborhood at 6:45 one morning to discuss with the owner whether they were interested in going kosher. We spent 10 minutes in this place talking to the owner about why we thought it would be good if he went kosher. And 30 minutes later, both he and I were inundated by phone calls from congregants wanting to know if the Dunkin' Donuts was kosher. Because they saw us stepping out. And in truth, not only did I step out as an act of social grace, I bought a cup of coffee in the Dunkin' Donuts before I sat to speak to the owner. And so I stepped out of Dunkin' Donuts, this other rabbi, and I only a cup of coffee at 7 in the morning, where you would think, who would see us? And both of us had the same experience. By 8 o'clock, we were inundated with people who wanted to know was the Dunkin' Donuts kosher. Because you have to be very careful when you go into establishments that are sometimes kosher, that you not give them an implied lecture when they're not kosher. But I think when you go into a restaurant, a fancy not kosher restaurant with a designated kosher meal for you, everybody understands that when you're sitting there eating your piece of salmon, it's because they bought you a piece of salmon They bought them a kosher meal from a kosher establishment that came in double wrapped. I'm not sure if that sociology was true in 1952. My sense is it probably was not, but I think it's very well established. How many of you had this experience where you go into a non-kosher restaurant and get a kosher meal ordered? And in Atlanta, it's even more common. You're blessed in New York with a collection of kosher restaurants. I think that that's what the question of what can you eat in a non-kosher restaurant is itself a complicated one. Assuming there's no Mar Zion problem, I think that halachic authorities say the following things. You can definitely order something kosher to drink without any appearance of impropriety, like a cup of coffee or a glass of soda or something like that. And even though people will see you drinking, they'll assume that what you're drinking is kosher rather than not kosher, because most of the things that are not kosher, most of the things that you drink are kosher. The question of whether a person in such a situation can or should order a fruit salad or even a vegetable salad is a good question. I think the practice is that people go into not kosher restaurants and order things that are obviously kosher, like fruit salad. And they do so based on the assumption that the utensils that are used in a not kosher restaurant are clean, they're eino benyomo, and they're cold. And they closely certify and they look at the fruits and vegetables to make sure that they're free of bugs. And I think many people, in fact, have the custom of eating a salad without any onions in a not-kosher restaurant, or a fruit salad in such a situation. And I think the argument goes that the utensils are eino benyomo, and they're clean, and they're cold, and the ingredients in a fruit salad or even a vegetable salad other than with onions is intrinsically kosher with no dressing. I think that that's a common practice that's out there, and there's a considerable amount of halakhic foundation to that practice. But I'll say as follows. A person should strive mightily to stay away from that, particularly in an environment like New York, where there are so many kosher restaurants to eat in. There are enormously significant reasons why a person should only patronize kosher establishments. When you're doing business in a place where there are no kosher restaurants, sometimes the economic pressure to go out to eat with your colleagues is enormous. And in such a situation, a person can go into a non-kosher restaurant, I think, and order a fruit salad. And the argument for that is as I specified before, it's eino benyomo. It's cold, the ingredients are always intrinsically certified as kosher, and that's a reasonable balance given the reality. I'm much less comfortable doing that in the context of a place where there is a kosher restaurant that you want to be patronizing than in a place where there isn't a kosher restaurant and business takes place in the context of food or drink. In such a situation, I think that one can rely on that view. Under no circumstances may you ever eat anything that's cooked in a not kosher restaurant, no matter what, and under no situations. Not fish, even if the fish is kosher, not vegetables, nothing that's cooked in any way, shape, or form can ever be eaten in a not kosher restaurant. This, to some extent, is a reflection of the differences between life in town and life out of town. And the truth is, there are many places out there where there are no kosher restaurants that you can take clients to. And professionals figure out what they can eat in not kosher restaurants, and a fruit salad is a reasonable compromise in a situation where there's not a kosher restaurant that a person can go to. The next issue that I want to address is yichud and gender touching, I want to try to address this in a two-fold way. I only want to discuss yichud in a professional setting, and I want to address the following question, which is, dealing with a person in a closed door in which the door is not locked. This is a common professional setting, which is a client wants to talk to you about something and they want the door closed. And there are all sorts of reasons why they want the door closed. If that situation itself raises you questions. I want to note, by the way, that I encountered this as a professor at Emory when it came to picking my office. In university, I made a very conscious choice, which I think is halakhically very wise. I picked the only office in the university, really, that has a window that overlooks a porch, so that students can stand outside my office and peer in. They come by frequently in the morning and they wave at me while I'm working away. They wave at me, and I think that in the ideal world, Orthodox professionals should strive very hard to design their office so that people can't hear, but you know what people can do? They can see in. And once they can see in, then you know what there is? No yichud problem at all. I encourage high schools to do this whenever I get asked. I'm a high school principal in an environment where there are boys and girls, and I frequently need to sit and talk to students about private matters. How do I handle this? I say to them that you should have an office with a glass wall. No curtain, no nothing, a glass wall, a glass door. The door closes, nobody can hear a thing that goes on in your office, but everybody can see. Yichud is avoided in any situation in which people can see you, and it's proper and appropriate for a Ben Torah to design his office if he's in a situation where he has to have private conversations with people where everybody can see what's going on. And the reason why you want to do that is it avoids any possible violation of Yichud, and it keeps people away from temptation. People will stop and stare, but they can't hear, and if they can't hear, there's nothing that they can understand. On a practical level, I tell people that they should put windows in their doors. If they can't have a glass wall, they should put a big window in their door so that people can see in. That avoids any situation of yichud at all, and that's an important observation. We live in a society full of temptation, and the first significant violation is not the sin itself, it's boundary crossing. Yichud is the central violation that leads to sexual impropriety. If you're deeply committed to never violating Hilchos Yichud in any way, shape, or form, you're well on your way to staying far away from sexual impropriety. Chazal were incredibly erudite, brilliant in the perspective of saying, don't put yourself in a place of temptation. Professionals should be very careful and meticulous to avoid problems in Hilchos Yichud. Nonetheless, I think Me'ikar HaDin, in a setting where people come into your office without knocking, in such a situation, I think you can deal with the person behind a closed but unlocked door based on a collection of Achronim who say that a closed but unlocked door is not a Yichud violation at all, particularly when you're in a professional setting where people don't knock and they just come in the door because they're entitled to do so. In those situations where people have asked me about this on a halakhah or maaseh level, I say you should hang a sign up outside your door which says, don't knock, just come in. Don't knock, just come in. And that if the combination of signs says, don't knock, just come in, and a closed door certainly avoids yichud problems, but it's not a good situation to put yourself in. A person who needs to be nityafed with patience or professional should put themselves in a situation in which everybody can see what's going on to avoid the appearance of impropriety that comes from violations of Hilchos Yichud. I don't think that this applies in the most complicated situations, which is, for example, a male doctor examining female patients. So you can't have a window, because the patient says, excuse me, I don't want to have a window. I don't have a window, and you can't have and anybody can knock. Anybody can walk in without knocking. You know what the patient says? The patient says, I'm not sitting in for an OBGYN exam. If the rule was anybody comes in whenever they want to. I think that in those kinds of situations, doctors have to create structures that avoid Hilchos Yichud. Sometimes by leaving the door open a crack, sometimes by saying to the patient, that given the reality of our time, it's inappropriate to be alone together with nobody coming in, and women nurses walk in and out, and that's just part of the rules of the game. You have to understand, while male nurses don't walk in and out without permission, female nurses do. And it's important to avoid a structure in which people are alone together with members of the opposite gender. And particularly as you set up your life, it's important to construct an office setting that's sensitive to health issues, either by getting the ground level office through the window, or by getting an office in which people who are outside the office can see in because you have a glass partition, or by some other construct that doesn't allow a person to ever be alone together with a client or a patient in the face of temptation. I think that that's we have Orthodox Jews need to grow more and more sensitive to this, and that this is a central barrier against impropriety in our world. We live in a world very different than our parents in the sense that sexual temptation is rampant, and the sexual morality of the world that's out there is markedly looser than it was 50 years ago. So the combination of temptation and loose morality leads sometimes even from people astray. Given that reality, the central barrier against violation is yichud. Yichud represents a central barrier. If you are meticulous in staying away from violating Hilchos Yichud, then you'll be meticulous in staying away from all sorts of violations. I go even further, by the way. I tell parents that it's impossible to raise your children without a computer. And that a computer is a central life skill and the internet is a source of information. But I tell parents something that people laugh at in the beginning. I say to them that of course you need to have a computer in your house, and of course your children have to learn how to use Google, but there should be no yichud with a computer either. A computer is an open access to pornography, and it represents a significant temptation to immorality. Others saying, hurrah, this is not good. A computer is like every other tool of modern times that can be used for good or bad. Somebody who says that we shouldn't have a computer at all because it can bring bad things into the house is sort of like saying we shouldn't have a hammer in the house because it can be used for bad things. The correct answer is you have to establish rules and procedures to make sure that hammers are used to drive the nails and not to discipline children. And the internet can be brought into the house because it's a significant tool for earning a living and for understanding what's going on in the world, for reading the New York Times and for all sorts, and for doing your math homework. My daughter sits down every night and does her math homework on the internet because the internet adds numbers up much faster than she can, faster than I can. And it's important, it's a skill and a tool we want all our children to learn. But it's also access to an incredible amount of schmutz and impropriety, and part of the way that we deal with this is you say that the office of Yisro is a lot of computer as well, and no being alone in your room with the computer. The computer sits in the dining room table or the kitchen table. Any child who wants to use the computer uses the computer. Thank God now our children are many different ages, and there are any number of computers in our household. Whether the 10-year-old needs a computer, the 17-year-old needs a computer, this one needs a computer, that one needs a computer, everybody, and finally so do I. But the computer sits out there in the open, and it's not something that people are encouraged to be alone with in their own room, but it's easy to be led astray. Yichud forms a very central barrier against sexual impropriety.
What about mental health professionals?
In what sense?
Yichud.
So again, I think that mental health professionals need to have a glass wall.
Not doable.
Why?
I strike with physical therapists. It's a locked door. The door is slightly open.
Locked door that's slightly open is okay as well. Why can't it be a glass wall?
You don't want to be seen, sometimes you don't want to be seen going into a mental health professional's office. And you have to be able to concentrate on what's going on in the office staff. There's always office staff.
So I'll tell you what I've proposed in situations where yichud is almost inevitable socially. I say to people that you should have a video camera in your room that your secretary can see projected elsewhere. And when your patient asks, you say it's because sometimes the patients get violent. Meaning the notion that you can be alone with your patient and nobody comes in, that's just a bad idea. It opens you to allegations from the patient that you did something wrong to the patient. A professional who deals in this situation and reserves the right to be in a locked room with the patient is in a bad situation. In situations like this, you need to say to your patient, there's a video camera over there, there's no sound recording, it records what goes on all the time, my secretary can see it, and there's a video record. It can't hear you, it can't hear me, but it makes sure that I don't touch you inappropriately and you don't touch me inappropriately.
The captain, my wife is on the other side of the door in the office. But, you know, having a secretary work for my wife for many years, but now, secretary, waiting there, the reception.
So I think if the door is closed and locked, that probably doesn't help. If the door is closed, that's minimally or roughly acceptable, but it's a bad idea to structure your life relying on a closed door in those kinds of situations. That's what I think. On an emergency exigent basis, I would allow that. In a situation where your wife is out there, that might be an even stronger hospital. See, most of us don't go to work with our wife sitting in the outer room. So I didn't address the question of yichud in one's house with another person with one's wife in the outer room, because that's an unusual professional setting. That would be, I think, a relatively unusual professional setting. I want to discuss briefly Shabbos issues in two ways. I want to discuss situations in which you want to give work to people on Friday and tell them, I'll be in Monday morning. You know what I want? I want the work done. That's what I want. I want the work done. Here it's Friday at 4 o'clock. Here is 10 hours worth of work. Have a good day. It better be done Monday morning or you're not working here. And the employee said, that's not a nice thing to do. To which you say, well, that's why I'm the boss and you're the employee. This is a very interesting question. It falls into two different paradigms. The first is the employee is not Jewish. And the second is the employee is Jewish. And it's very common that in such situations, you're a partner in a law firm giving out assignments over the weekend that, you know what? All your associates are Jewish. Because it's not uncommon in a major New York law firm that half the associates are Jewish. In some departments, I worked in a Davis Polk and Wardwell many years ago in the bankruptcy department for a little bit, and there were more members of the bankruptcy department that served in the Israeli army than in the American army when I was at Davis Polk and Wardwell. Everybody was Jewish, not everybody was from. These were two different social constructs of a child. Asking a non-Jew before Shabbat to do something to be done on Monday morning is always mukter. And the reason why it's always mukter is because you can rely on the fact that the non-Jew can do the work on Sunday. Now, you know that you know when the non-Jew is going to do the work? On Shabbat. How come? Because given the way they live their life, they'd rather work on Saturday than on Sunday. That's not a problem. The halacha is clear in that situation that you can ask a non-Jew to do the work, even though you know the non-Jew will do the work on Shabbos, because they can do it on Sunday. No different than dropping your car off at an auto mechanic's Friday afternoon and saying, I'll pick the car up Monday morning. You know the mechanic will do the work on Shabbos, but it's sufficient that the non-Jew can do the work on Sunday so that whenever they choose to do the work, you know why they're doing it then? Because they want to. A non-Jew who does work on Shabbos for their convenience is doing it for their convenience. Of course, you can't do this in a situation where, let's say, Saturday is Shabbos and Sunday is the second day of Rosh Hashanah. But because in that situation there's no secular day between the 2 days, but on a routine weekend, you can ask a non-Jew to do work over the weekend, even though you know fully well that they're going to do the work on Shabbos and not on Sunday, because it's their choice to engage in this work. I think this is true, by the way, even if you're giving them 20 hours work. And what's going to realistically happen is, you know when they're going to work? All day Shabbos, and then they're going to come in and work all day Sunday, and they're angry, unhappy employees. But the nature of the job is sometimes you have to do this, and you can rely on the fact that as a matter of halacha, you know what they can do? They can work all day, some day, Sunday night. But they used to say law firm hours. Law firm hours, the Davis Polk thing, used to joke, started at 5 in the morning, and they ended at 5 the next morning. Meaning you can rely on the fact that the non-Jew can do 20 hours worth of work from Saturday night to Monday morning, even though you know, in fact, that the non-Jew will not do 20 hours worth of work starting Motzei Shabbos on Saturday night until Sunday morning. They'll work 10 days Shabbos, 10 days Sunday, 10 hours Shabbos, 10 hours Sunday, but you can rely on the fact that they're going to do this work, that it's sufficient that they can do the work in that situation. Now the question of how to handle Jewish employees in this situation is really very hard. And it's even harder when you step back and ask the question differently. I have a business, and I'm looking to hire an employee. And I know the nature of the work that I'm going to give the employee entails a weekend work. Should I specifically look to hire a Jew or a goy? Should I look to hire a goy in such a situation? Now, you could make a claim that since you know the work entails some work on the weekends, you should specifically look to hire a goy. And yet, on the other hand, it grates on us to engage in that exact form of unpleasant hiring. I think there are two halachic distinctions here at play. The first is a situation in which you know the work entails Shabbos work, and the job description includes working on Shabbos. If the job description includes working on Shabbos, then you have to hire a non-Jew to do this work. You need somebody to come in and work Saturdays from 9 to 6 as a security guard, because your office needs a security guard, like Yeshiva does. If you're spent Shabbos here, you know what you see on Shabbos? Security guards. How come? Because if there was a Shabbos without security guards, there'd be no Yeshiva on Sunday. So there are security guards. That makes perfect sense. They're not Jewish. That also makes perfect sense. But when you're hiring an attorney, and there's no specific Shabbos work, it's just you know there's tons of work, and there'll be weekends where employees work, I don't think there's any halakhic obligation that you have to hire non-Jewish attorneys. Indeed, I think you could make a reasonable claim that it's perfectly proper in that situation to hire Jewish employees. And the same rationale that you give to your non-Jewish employees can apply to your Jewish employees as well, which is when you give them a day of weekend work, in a situation where you give them a day of weekend work, you can rely on the fact that they can do the work on Sunday, even though you suspect that some of them will do the work on Shabbos. And again, the rationale is that the choice is not yours, the choice is theirs. And in a situation where the choice is theirs, we go back to our initial conversation, there's no obligation, lahasrish yehudi me'isr, to separate a Jew from sin, in those situations in which the Jew is a knowing, willful, and intentional sinner. So in such a situation, I think not only can you hand a non-Jewish associate 10 hours worth of work Friday at 3 o'clock, I think you can hand your Jewish associate 10 hours worth of work Friday at 3 o'clock, even though you suspect that you're going to leave at 3:15 to go home for Shabbos, and they're going to stay Friday night and work for 10 hours. That's their choice. That's not your choice. But you can't do those. You can't hand a Jewish associate 10 hours worth of work Friday at 3 o'clock and say, I'll be in Motzei Shabbat. I expect the work to be done in that situation. I haven't addressed here the question of assigning Shabbos work to Jewish employees when you're in a healthcare profession so that you can put forward an argument that the work is mutter to do on Shabbos. I think that that's a much easier case, and that in a situation in which a person is in a healthcare profession, it might even be better to assign this work to not from people than to from people under the rationale that it might reasonably be mutter. And it's better for a non-from person to work in a hospital on Shabbos than to putter around the gospel. That's a famous dispute between Rav Moshe and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that Rabbi Steinberg has written up in one of the issues of Asya. I don't remember the exact reference. I want to conclude with a more general comment about Kedoshim Tiyu and preserving Jewish identity. The gap between the social mores of Orthodox Jews and everybody else has expanded rather than contracted in the last 50 years because Western society has grown That's traditional. And it's important that people enter into the workforce to earn a living, which is a good and wonderful thing. And economic insularity is a bad thing that frequently produces sinful behavior out of economic desperation. So I'm all in favor of people working for a living in the standard professions that Yeshiva College historically trains people for. It's important, though, to recognize that the world out there is a tempting place, and not all the temptations that are out there are kosher at all. And that if you're going to live the life of a frum Jew in the secular workforce, the mantra of Kedoshim Tiyu is exceptionally important. And it mandates that you all the time stay away from impropriety, and you commit yourself to living without temptation of sin, never mind sin, and you seek to emulate in every way that you can the best possible behavior, but it has to be tempered with the reality of life, which is earning a living is an important economic activity. I've attempted to provide today with some guidance on how to address situations in four different areas of halacha. I hope that I succeeded in doing this. I know there are questions, but I can't answer them. Not because I don't have any answers. I might not have the answers, but I can't answer them in fact, because I have to run to be someplace else to do a class in women's school. My email address is mbroyde@emory.edu. I incessantly answer emails on my cell phone for those who want to talk in person. It's 917-208-5011. And if you didn't like something I said this year, or you think it needs elaboration, you should feel free to email me or call me. It's rude. I'm embarrassed. It's rude to give a shiur that addresses such important and complex questions and then run away. But I have to give a shiur at 10:30, 5 minutes away. So it's 10:35. I have to give a shiur 5 minutes away at 10:30, and you're just out of luck. I'm very sorry. I apologize. You shouldn't think I'm running away because I can't. I just have to be someplace else. Thank you very much.